question. Did you see the news last night? Them savages from Atlanta that went into that T-Mobile store, drove their car in there, got away about 100 phones.
Yeah, man, it's crazy out here. Man. It's that time of year, though, I guess.
Yeah, it's crazy. Hey, yo, and that reminds me, listen, if you know somebody that needs an iPhone, tell them holler at me if they with T-Mobile. I got the hookup for the low.
Got you, man.
I appreciate
all
that.
Right.
That's Alfred, a.k.a. Paperboy from the show Atlanta, talking to his barber, Bibby. We'll talk about why Atlanta is one of the best shows on TV. That's coming up in a few minutes. First, though, Austin Buettner is the new chief of the Los Angeles Public School System. Buettner is a philanthropist. He's a former deputy mayor, former LA Times publisher, not much experience in public education, although he founded a charity to give glasses to students who can't afford them. So, an unconventional choice to head the LAUSD for sure, but a good one. We're going to get a few perspectives now. Buettner has plenty of supporters, including many in the charter school movement. Mirna Castrejon is executive director of Great Public Schools Now. That's a nonprofit which has funded charter schools and LA Unified Schools. Welcome. Well, Austin Buettner, good choice or not?
Well, I think Mr. Buettner is poised to be an unconventional superintendent, but these are unconventional times, and the district is facing a tremendous amount of challenges that require a varied set of expertise and experience. So it is a unique choice, but I think he certainly collects a lot of the qualities that we've been public about the district needing in its next superintendent.
And what is that? Can you lay that out quickly?
Well, for sure, strong management skills. The district is the biggest public agency in California, and that requires a great amount of political skills as well. And certainly the challenges that the district faces regarding its structural debt and the many aspects of the operations of such a large district require a varied set of skills beyond just those of a traditional educator.
Okay, let's bring in Alex Caputo-Pearl now. He is the president of United Teachers Los Angeles. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's your response?
Yeah, I mean, overall, this has been one of the shortest and least inclusive superintendent selection processes ever for a major urban district in the United States. And it's clear that the reason Board President Monica Garcia and Board Vice President Nick Melvoin have fast-tracked it is because they want to be able to vote on it before their colleague, their criminally indicted colleague, Ref Rodriguez, on the board, goes to trial. So it's been fast-tracked, and that's a problem. It is a problem that Austin Buettner is not an educator. There are plenty of educators to choose from who are leaders, who are managers, who are visionaries, et cetera. He's not an educator. He comes out of private equity and hedge funds and investment banking, where actually the goal is to buy companies and figure out how to make profits off of them, often resulting in layoffs, often resulting in driving institutions to bankruptcy, et cetera. Those aren't the qualities that we need right now in a superintendent. What we need to focus on is the issues that parents care about: class size, counselors, getting more librarians, broadening the curriculum, retaining and recruiting great teachers. That's what we need to be focusing on, and we are very concerned about the choice of Austin Buettner.
Well, what about the financial aspect of it? Healthcare costs are huge. Apparently, the district is spending about $1 billion, or it will very soon, on healthcare for current and retired employees, as well as pensions for former employees. That's going to continue to eat up the budget. Does the district need a good financial manager to keep these costs in line?
Of course, any institution needs a good financial manager, but some of these issues are pretty straightforward. We need to get the district to actually, instead of sitting on a $1.7 billion reserve, actually put that reserve towards some of these things like class size and more counselors, et cetera. Certainly, we need to be together in driving what the teachers' union and community organizations have campaigned around, the 20 by 20 campaign, which is to get our per pupil funding at the state level to $20,000 per student by the year 2020. Right now, California is 46 out of 50 among the 50 states in per pupil funding. And thirdly, yes, we need to get control of hemorrhaging that's happening because of the growth of privatization and the growth of unregulated charter schools to the tune of $600 million per year being drawn out of neighborhood schools. Certainly we need a good financial manager who's going to take on those issues. It does not need to be a hedge fund and private equity manager who comes out of investment banking, though. It can be an educator who gets the in the classroom and in the school issues and also is thinking about those very financial issues.
Mirna, what about some of the points that Alex makes that we need, first and foremost, an educator who understands how to craft education policy and that, yeah, sure, the district has financial problems, but first and foremost, education policy needs to be addressed.
Well, I mean, I certainly don't disagree that education policy experience is incredibly important. But certainly we see that the scale of the challenge in Los Angeles, there won't be any education policy to make if the district goes bankrupt. It is absolutely important that we are able to do both things at once. And there's certainly nothing in Mr. Buettner's resume that would suggest that he is not civic-minded, that he doesn't have a strong record of actually leading in public agencies, given his role as deputy mayor that was widely regarded as successful, his role within the Clinton administration as well. I think to suggest that the only experience that he would bring to bear are those in private business is looking at it through a very narrow prism. And in fact, it's not just the superintendent, but it's also the board who sets policy and responsible for carrying out that vision. We certainly see that in the last couple of weeks, in particular, this board has been very proactive in doing exactly what Mr. Caputo-Pearl has suggested needs to be done, and that is directing resources to the highest need schools, approving resolutions that have to do with closing the equity gap, and ensuring that high quality teachers are in every classroom, and that is a priority, especially with high need schools. So this is a false choice.
Okay, let me bring in a parent now. Sarah Roos is a parent of a student at Hamilton High School. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. Okay, so what is your reaction to the choice of Austin Buettner as the next superintendent?
Well, I agree there's a false choice here. I don't see why he's a choice at all. He isn't an educator. His record as a financial manager is questionable indeed. His record in public works has been questionable. More to the point, we also have a current superintendent who is acting as the superintendent who has been doing a very good job, is a fine manager, is all of the things that you're looking for, and critically, is an educator. When I send my child to school, I expect that they are going to a system that's being led by a person who's familiar with best practices in education, not in money making, money investment, money managing. That's a different set of skills.
Right. But what about, and you're speaking of Vivian Ekchian, as she's the interim superintendent. What about what Mirna just said in terms of, well, if this district goes bankrupt, there isn't going to be any education policy to make?
Well, it's hard to see how you can call the district bankrupt when it's sitting on, as Mr. Caputo-Pearl pointed out, a $1.7 billion reserve year after year. Money is being held over year after year, which is absurd. That money is there to be spent on our children. It could be used to actually make our class sizes less than 50 kids per teacher. It's just a bad situation, but it's not because there isn't money and there isn't expertise in the system to deal with it. It's because there are these outside forces that are trying to manipulate things according to a totally different agenda of, you know, maximizing somebody else's profit instead of the common public good of educating our kids with that money. It's not about a profit situation. It's about raising children well.
Alex, let me bring you back here. And it is an all but certainty that Austin Buettner will be the next superintendent. So how do you plan to work with him going forward if you're so critical of him?
Well, we've been critical of superintendents in the past and have been very careful to meet with them and work with them on whatever we can. So that would be no different if Austin Buettner is the choice here. My concern is this. I mean, Mirna raises the point that there's not going to be educational policy to have purview over if the district runs bankrupt. There are some very different perspectives on exactly how to build a sustainable school district. I taught for 22 years in Compton Unified School District and in South Los Angeles, and the model that many of the promoters of Austin Buettner as superintendent has led to the Detroit and New Orleans school systems not really being public systems anymore. They're basically sort of loosely connected networks of privatized charter schools that don't serve all students, that have a very hard time recruiting and retaining the best educators, et cetera. That's one model. You just drive it towards that. The model that we're interested in is, yes, taking on things like the $1.7 billion reserve that exists in LAUSD. Yes, taking on getting the state of California, the sixth largest economy in the world, to actually get out of 46th place among 50. But third, and crucially, actually not being a part of the privatization agenda. We're very concerned that Austin Buettner has family and business ties to Amway, which is the business that Betsy DeVos her family used to make money. We're concerned that Evercore, which is the private equity firm that Mr. Buettner worked for years ago, actually helped build the media empire of David Pecker, who's a main confidant and fixer for Donald Trump. Trump and DeVos they're moving a privatization agenda, and that's not the way we need to move.
Okay, so you're afraid that he is going to further privatize LAUSD and create more charter schools?
Absolutely, because those are the backers, and he sits on a couple of charter boards, which have promoted unregulated growth to the $600 million a year detriment of neighborhood schools.
All right, so we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you all for joining us. That was Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of United Teachers LA. We also heard from Myrna Castrejon, executive director of the nonprofit Great Public Schools Now, and Sarah Roos, a parent of a high school student at Hamilton High here in LA. Coming up, California's highest court takes aim at the gig economy, ruling that independent contractors like Uber drivers have certain rights. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's estimated that more than 12 million Americans work in the gig economy, Uber drivers, freelance writers. California's highest court yesterday issued a unanimous decision that says if those workers are at the core of a business, they must have standard worker protections, such as a minimum wage. The ruling could significantly alter the way these companies operate. And here with more is Harley Shaken. He's a labor economist at UC Berkeley. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
Well, tell us more about this ruling. What did it say?
It's a very big ruling because it affects, as you pointed out, so many people. At its core, it provides a new standard for judging whether someone's an employee or an independent contractor. Before, there was a 10-point set of criteria that had to be applied. It's starting with to what extent does the company direct your activity. Now the criteria are far simpler. 3 points, the most central one, is what the worker does, a core part of the business or a usual part of its activity. It doesn't mean that things will change overnight, but it is a huge step toward giving more protections to these 12 million people in the gig economy and so many others that are freelance or classified as contractors.
So give us an example of how it would change the way things operate. Let's say I'm a permalancer, as they're called, people who are permanently freelancing. And let's say I'm working for a company for, let's say I've got a contract for a year. Am I not a contract worker, or would I be covered by these worker protections?
Well, it depends on what you're doing for that year. It's not the length of time so much. Is if what you're doing is a core part of the business, then you're absolutely eligible for being classified as an employee. Now, here's where it gets a little murky. It doesn't necessarily mean you will become an employee. Why? Because the company can argue that it doesn't have enough control over your work environment to make that happen. That's the primary criteria in many ways right now. So if this sounds a little confusing, look at the example that was before the court. The company named Dynamex. Before 2004, all its drivers were employees. In 2004, nothing changed, but Dynamex classified them as independent contractors. Well, the court ruled that that alone, that reclassification, isn't sufficient. But it ruled that they were, in fact, still contractors because the company did not exercise enough control over what they actually did. So the ruling is very important. It sets a new standard, but how it's applied will be equally important. And we're certainly going to see a lot of work for attorneys in this area.
So when you look at a company like Uber or Lyft, would this go at the heart of their entire business?
Absolutely. It gives them three options. First, they make everyone who's currently driving for them an employee. Some of them will have flexible hours, work fewer hours, but they're employees. Second, they redefine the business. So they put you in direct contact with the drivers in a way that doesn't quite exist right now. And third, they seek to hang on to what exists now through a long set of legal challenges. Any way you cut it, it's going to be a real challenge for Uber going forward. Now, this is the California Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court, but Uber and Lyft both are based in California, and California, of course, is the sixth largest economy in the world.
Right. So Uber has always argued that it's not a taxi company, it's a technology company, that it's just facilitating this arrangement between two private parties, that that's its core business. That's what you're talking about with number two?
Exactly. So the core business, the fact that Uber says its core business is being simply an online platform that puts you in contact with its freelancers. But the reality, I suspect, given this ruling, could be interpreted much differently. There's a lot of things you must do as an Uber driver, and when you use the Uber app, you're not looking for a platform, you're looking for a ride. The driver provides the ride, so what the driver does unquestionably is not simply a core part of the business, it really is the business, why you're contacting Uber in the first place. So there's going to be a lot of challenges to that, but this Supreme Court ruling is awfully important because it sets a new standard as the basis for the challenges.
Well, practically, though, what are the immediate effects of this? If it is going to be caught up in legal challenges, will workers see any results from this at all in the coming years?
We'll see how things unwind. It certainly gives wind behind the sails of those who have been arguing that simply classifying a worker as a contractor or a freelancer ought not to be enough to unwind all the protections we've had in the workplace since the mid-1930s and even before. So it gives a lot of impetus to that, and it may lead organized groups of workers to be able to give that some reality. I suspect we will see more cases challenging this. And will Uber change overnight? I suspect not. But it raises this as a real challenge for the company, and we'll see, you know, how this plays out.
Harley Shaken is a labor economist, and he teaches at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for more background on how the gig economy affects workers, you can check out our series from last year on the future of work. You can find it at kcrw.com/investigates. Coming up, why the TV show Atlanta is one of the best TV shows on the air right now.
And it's weirder, it's deeper, it's smarter. There's nothing I dislike about it.
Unapologetically Black and Southern, Atlanta, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk now about one of the best shows on TV and one of the weirdest.
Would you like some?
What is that?
It's a soft-boiled ostrich egg. It's called an owl's casket.
Oh, I'm good.
A scene from Atlanta. The guy offering the ostrich egg is a recluse. He's living in a dusty mansion. He looks like Michael Jackson. He's played by the creator of Atlanta, Donald Glover, in whiteface. It is one of the most disturbing episodes of TV I've seen in a long time. And here to talk about season two of Atlanta, we have Han Nguyen. She's senior editor for IndieWire, and she joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Michael Harriet, he's staff writer at The Root, and he joins us from Alabama. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, and I just want a warning for listeners who haven't perhaps seen the whole episode and plan to binge it later. There might be spoilers, so spoiler alert. Okay, so you both love the show, I know that. Give us one quick sentence as to why, and let's begin with you, Michael.
I think Atlanta is the blackest and most Southern show that's ever been on TV in combination.
And that's why you love it so much?
That's why I love it.
Okay. And Han?
Atlanta is something that defies sort of definition for me, but it makes me feel, and whether it's laughter or fear or discomfort, I'm always like just surprised at how much I feel when I watch it.
Hmm. It gives you the feels. Okay. Yeah. And what about this season as compared to last season?
Well, I would say it's better. It's not that the first season was wonderful, but I think this season has more of a through line. I think from the beginning, I think it has a master plan, and I can feel that throughout when I'm watching it. And it's weirder, it's deeper, it's smarter. There's nothing I dislike about it.
And Michael, what is it about this show that is so intriguing? Why is it so weird, first of all?
Well, I think it's weird in that it's so real because it foregoes exposition, it foregoes explaining anything that, and it assumes that the viewer is in on the jokes and is in on every cultural reference, which is, so it's more like a natural conversation than anything we've seen on TV. You know, they have these moments in the show where everyone seems to know what they're talking about, and they feel no need to explain to those who don't understand what they need to talk about. And I think that's the genius of the show.
So it's like unapologetically Black about Black culture, and it's not explaining itself to a broader audience.
Right.
I want to play a clip of tape that maybe illustrates what you're talking about. This is from one of the episodes where Paperboy, he's the rapper who's at the center of the show, or he's the star, and he's kind of a reluctant star, I guess, a reluctant rap star. And because he wants to keep it real. He wants to be just a regular guy, but also he has to contend with his burgeoning celebrity. And in this episode, he's going to his barber, his name is Bibby, to get a haircut, who's a friend of his. And the entire episode, he's trying to get a haircut, and he just can't get a haircut.
So what are we doing now?
Like I said, man, the usual.
All right, the usual, damn. The usual. You don't want to do nothing different?
No, man, look, I got a photo shoot coming up, man, so I just
want
to look good.
Oh, you got a photo shoot coming up.
Yeah, man.
Oh, you Hollywood now, huh?
Nah, man. It's a write-up for me in a magazine. It's a write-up in a magazine, and they want to take some pictures, so that's what I'm
doing. Hey, you dating Kim Kardashian now? That's what that is?
No.
My boy done went straight Hollywood on me. That's good.
It ain't no Hollywood, baby. I ain't going no Hollywood.
Okay, and then he basically has to chase Bibby around on his errands or whatever he's doing, all his crazy hijinks, to try to get him to finish the haircut. It's really a funny episode. Michael, what is it about that episode that speaks to you?
Well, first of all, every person that I've talked to about that episode, we all know a Bibby, not just a barber like that. We've all been to that barbershop. It's like every black barbershop in every neighborhood. But there is always one guy who's a hustler. He sells cell phones. He does construction on the side. He wants you to, he needs a ride to go pick up his kids. And that's Bibby.
I have to say, it was really frustrating, too, as a viewer, right, hon? Like, I was like, why doesn't he just leave? Why does he keep following Bibby around to try to, you know, going on all these crazy errands with him? Why doesn't he just say, okay, enough, I'll get my haircut by someone else?
That is very correct. It's frustrating, but therein lies the humor, because I'd been talking to the writer of the episode, Stephanie Robinson. She's, by the way, the only female writer and the youngest writer on the staff for Atlanta, and she was saying that it is absolutely that person that everyone knows, but they also, because you're so reliant on this one person who knows how to do your hair, you're almost like held hostage by them. You can't not go along with their schemes because, you know what? They're going to make you look good. You can't trust it with anyone else with
right,
their hair.
Right. And there's this relationship that's formed between the two of them.
It's all love.
Yeah, sort of.
Sort of.
Until it isn't. All right. I also want to talk about the scene that we played in the intro and that episode, the Teddy Perkins episode. Hon, can you tell me what was going on in that episode? Just, I don't know if you can talk about it in sort of a meta sense, but just what was that episode about?
Wow, that's not a hard question at all. Well, the nice thing about Atlanta is that there is no real wrong answer. You can interpret it any way you like. However, clearly there are associations with Michael Jackson, his Teddy Perkins' white skin tone, whereas previous photos of him have him with darker skin. And so some people suppose that it might have to do with, you know, child stars and how that stardom changes you, and abuse. Joe Jackson, I know, was definitely one person who is seen as having changed his kids. And so that could be interpreted in that way. And then, you know, with his brother or not brother in the house, it's almost like a whatever happened to Baby Jane situation going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was like a horror movie.
Absolutely.
And Michael, what about for you? What did that episode bring up for you when it obviously touching on the Michael Jackson idea of what it means to be a star, a pop star, and also, you know, that sort of that self-hatred and transformation of his skin color and all that.
Right. And one of the things that I interpreted is in that Teddy had adjusted and to his pain by embracing and putting on whiteness. And it was an attempt to overcome all of the previous pain in his life. And it was almost a metaphor of black people being trapped in this house with their families and being in this place that they had no involvement in being in. And the only way to deal with that kind of pain and that kind of prison imprisonment is to change your skin and become like your captors to get over being captured. And I think that's one of the things that episode was about to me, and how Darius saw that. And at the end, he told the man, like, we all hurt. We all feel that pain, but you have to let it go. And that's one of the ingenious things about Atlanta, is because it can be interpreted in so many ways.
Mm. So you said earlier at the start of our conversation that you like this show because it is the most Southern show on TV. And I want to talk about the latest episode, because that really brings up some Southern issues, right? So the guys find themselves at a white frat house, and they're sitting in front of a Confederate flag, and they're kind of... I mean, they're sitting there with all these white frat boys who, you know, they're in the middle of some hazing ritual and a bunch of naked men in front of them. And It's again, a very surreal scene. What did that bring up for you, Michael, that episode?
Well, I think it symbolized the Southern existence of Black people, right? You exist alongside, because we all see the things on TV and the Confederate monuments and the whole debate about it. And we always reason inside ourselves that if it were me, I'd do this or I'd say something. But most of the time, especially in the South, we coexist around that imagery, right? We sit in the same rooms and accept it, and not because we have to be there or because we accept the logic behind it, but it's just part of the scenery in the South, and especially in Georgia. I am a former resident of Atlanta, and I'm in Atlanta probably twice a month. And you can't be upset or can't get outraged every time you see a Southern flag. And so it is a symbol of white supremacy. On the other hand, you've become numb to it, and it's just a thing that is on the wall in the background of the scenery.
I know. And for us, it's shocking because we don't see it here in California that much.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure
not
it's there,
much.
But we don't, it's not like part of the scenery. There's a great scene in that Teddy Perkins episode at the beginning where Darius is at a store and he buys a hat. This is the South. And so it says Southern made on it. And he buys a pen and he crosses out a bunch of letters. So it says, "You mad." And he just puts it on kind of without comment. And there's a white woman gives him a dirty look or whatever. And he just wears it and he doesn't say anything about it. And I just love the subtlety of that.
I love it, too. I love there's so much commentary packed in that one act. Is it an act of defiance, or does he just need a hat? Right? Or is it just his weirdness? Everything can be interpreted on so many levels. Again, which is one of the things that makes the show so much of a good experience for different audiences. You know, one person might see it in a different way, and one person might just take it as a 30 minutes of entertainment for their Thursday evening.
Interesting. Yeah, and Earn, who Donald Glover plays, he's kind of not as interesting as the other characters. He doesn't really dominate the screen when he's on.
Well, that's the interesting thing. In some ways, you start out thinking that maybe I should be identifying with Earn because I'm not in Hollywood or I'm not trying to be a rapper or things like that. But that actually seems to be his failing, is because he's not quite getting what else is going on around him. So he's kind of like just taking it all in, but he's not really like engaging with it quite how everyone else is. He's not present. But I think that's why we've been seeing him go through such a change this season.
So he's managing his cousin and Paperboy, and he's not really doing a great job.
No, not at all. it's kind of an irony that his name is Earn and he can't get that money. But I think in the last episode we saw Alfred actually has to come to terms with his cousin and fire him. And because he hasn't really been getting all the gigs and hasn't been getting him the endorsement deals or any of that type of stuff. And Earn thinks he's been doing everything correctly. And yet, you know, he's just always losing out. That's in his eyes. He's losing out. So we have two more episodes left. I think we'll find out exactly how much he's learned by the time, hopefully, the season ends and see if maybe he seems more interesting. Maybe he gets an opinion and does something and is proactive.
So finally, where do you think that this show is gonna go? I mean, it's hinting at a dark direction.
It's very exciting, actually, because they've broken so many of the rules of TV, which is great, that we've been shocked throughout the whole season. I mean, I would not be surprised if someone died, someone we actually cared about. I don't think they would, just because, well, supposedly this is a comedy. But people have been hurt. We've seen Paperboy get beat up, mugged. And then just what happened to Earn recently, he got beat up on his own. You know, that was his own choice there in the way. But he was punishing himself. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if something major happened. The very first scene of the whole season is a robbery with guns and gunfire, and it's shocking, but it set the tone. This was a darker, scarier season, so I would not be surprised if they went out with a bang somehow.
literally.
Yes, literally.
Michael, what do you think?
I think it may be headed that way, but we have to remember that it doesn't adhere to any formal storytelling routine, so it may just not fizzle out, but there doesn't seem to be a need for confrontation or resolution in the show. So I predict that it may end again as Earn's relationship with Paperboy is going. It might just end up in a situation where everybody decides to just coexist in a different kind of way. And what way that will be is yet to be seen. But I think one of the things about the show is, even though they don't display this outwardly love for each other, you can tell that they are interconnected. Even when Alfred was telling Earn that he basically was going to fire him, he said, and if you caught this, that I have to earn for my mother, I have to earn for you. I have to, you know, so he was saying that I'm doing this for all of us. And so it's yet to be seen where this is going. And it's going to be interesting every step of the way, one thing you can be sure of.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking about this today with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
That's Michael Harriet, staff writer at The Root, and Han Nguyen, senior editor for IndieWire. Coming up, the five healthy habits that can extend lives by a long time, but few people are doing them all. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW Donation Car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. San Diego craft brewers Border X recently announced plans to open a new location here in the L.A. area this fall. The people behind those brews are known for putting a Mexican spin on traditional types of beer, so think horchata stouts or a sour made with cucumber and lime. Border X's arrival in L.A. adds to a growing craft scene that's looking to court Latino drinkers by using ingredients commonly found south of the border. And here to talk about this is Javier Cabral. He's a food writer based in East L.A. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, Border X, it's going to open in Bell this fall. And tell us more about Border X.
Border X is a brewery in San Diego. And they make beers that have, you know, things like jamaica, which is hibiscus, you know, or horchata. And, you know, these ingredients that a lot of Latinos in the SoCal area, they are driven to because they grew up eating them, drinking them.
Mm-hmm. So it's more than just a marketing ploy. It's actual flavors for the beers.
Yes. And you know what? And I've actually tasted it. That was the tail end of my bachelor party a couple of months ago. And I tasted it and I really enjoyed their beers. And the crazy thing for me is, you know, usually you associate craft beer with, you know, white men with beards and you know, a kind of a bro-y kind of atmosphere. But when I went there, there was a lowrider gang hanging out outside drinking jamaica beer. And it was really unique. And it blew my mind because it was like both of my worlds colliding.
And so jamaica beer, does it taste like jamaica and beer?
Of course, yeah. You know, there are some sour beers that people are loving right now, and jamaica by nature is a tart taste.
Yeah.
So when you know how to brew it correctly, it could definitely taste good, and it also adds a really nice color that looks like blood.
So it's a bloody beer. But and then the horchata, is it kind of like a cinnamony taste?
Yes, it is a cinnamony taste, but not too much, and it's not too sweet. Which, you know, if you love beer, you want to balance always, no matter what the ingredients are. And it's interesting because I really do think that Border X is going to be the tipping point in LA County for breweries that are trying to court Latino clientele. Because aside from them, there are other breweries that have been doing this. There's Progress Brewing in El Monte, There's Pacific Plate in Monrovia. There's Wiretap in Lincoln Heights that also just opened up. And these all have really good beers too. And even then you would see some crossover beers from the bigger craft brewers like Stone. They have their beer called Chocovesa, which is a joint project between Insurgentes, because in Mexico it's a whole other ballpark.
Because why? Is it more established in Mexico than
No,
here?
it's not that, because you know there's two different markets. There are the Mexican Americans or the Latino Americans, you know, who their parents are from there, or their families is from Mexico or Central America. And then you have Mexico, which there are Mexicans, and there are a ton of breweries in Tijuana and in Ensenada that, because they're so close to San Diego, they get some spillover, and they have some really good beers too. Like Insurgentes is one of those breweries.
And can you get those beers here?
It's becoming easier. Yes, you could get them. They're still a little hard to find because of distribution, and it's kind of expensive to ship over into US. But you know, it's all good. I mean, I still recommend just going down into Tijuana to try these beers.
But you can still get a Mexican beer here easily at Tecate, for example.
Yes, Tecate. Tecate, Corona, Modelo, Negra Modelo. Those have always been here. But now there's the smaller brewers in Mexico who are getting started, and these big breweries are becoming really scared because they're like, well, they're multiplying.
So maybe they'll just buy them out, as they tend to do, like with Golden Happening, Road and things like that.
It's happening, yeah.
What is the difference between a Mexican lager and like a German lager?
Well, you know, that question is a really good one. And, you know, and actually had the opportunity to interview the BorderX founder. His name is David Favela. And I asked him, and his answer was really kind of stopping in my tracks. He responded, there's no such thing as a Mexican lager, because Vienna lager is from Vienna. However, someone in Mexico made it, and that was the birth of this thing, a Mexican lager. And, you know, because in a lot of climates in Mexico, it's really hot and like a crisp, light ABV beer. That's what a Mexican lager is, I think. And he also told me a really good quote that summarizes BorderX. He's like, we're not Irish, we're not German, so why try to make those kind of beers? Let's make Mexican beer.
Okay, so when we think of Mexican beer, we tend to think of Corona or Tecate or Negra Modelo, like those beers. Yeah. Are those truly Mexican beers?
That depends on who you ask. You know, a lot of those beers, maybe all of those beers that you mentioned, are owned by Constellation Brands, which is not a Mexican company. It's what's happening in all of the beer world in general. It's just, you know, breweries are getting bought out by the handful. So. Mm. It depends on who you ask. You know, it's hard because it's not black and white. But you know, if you're at a family party or if you're in Mexico and the only beer that they have is a Pacifico, like, are you gonna drink it? I mean, I will. I'm not gonna like boycott it like that. You know, so you know, it's tricky. It's tricky.
Okay, so if I do want to try any of these more interesting Mexican craft beers, do I have to wait for BorderX to open, or are there places I can go now to sample this?
No, you don't. Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, there are a couple of breweries that are owned by Latino owners, and that is Progress Brewing in El Monte. They make some really tasty beers. There is Pacific Plate in Monrovia, which also they have a really good mango IPA. Wiretap in Lincoln Heights, which they make a Mexican strong ale. That's like a stronger version of a Mexican lager. That's really tasty as well. And you know, and even then, you're seeing these other beers on the market now that you know you'll see like a Mexican chocolate stout that's made with Mexican cinnamon.
Mm, so that sounds really good. It sounds like dessert.
Yes, it is dessert, but you know it's still good beer, and you don't have to wait for BorderX to open. But I mean, whenever they do open, definitely go check them out.
Okay, check them out in Bell. Javier Cabral, food writer based in East LA. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, too much good beer and Mexican food might not be good for your health. Yet another study just came out about that. Not about beer and Mexican food exactly, but about how much longer we might live if we employ 5 healthy lifestyle habits. No surprises here. Eat your vegetables. Don't get fat. Exercise every day. Don't smoke. Don't drink too much. If you do all these things, the study predicts you'll live 14 years longer if you're a woman, 12 years longer if you're a man. Our resident Norwegian, Christian Bordahl, is here now. Hi.
Hey there.
You do all those things, right?
On a good day.
You're going to live to be 180.
But what is the quality of life, Madeline? That's the question.
Like, right.
If you have to exercise all the time and eat really carefully, and don't you want to just smoke and drink and have a good time
and eat a donut?
Die when you're 55?
No.
No.
I don't. But okay, so we all know these things,
yeah.
Right? No surprises.
Yeah.
So why don't we do them?
Exactly. And that's what I really found interesting about this study was everyone knows exactly. I mean, all of these five things are just like generic, right? We know all of them. But how many people do you think in that study actually do all five of those things?
Like five.
8%. 8%, right? And maybe that's not surprising. So I called this guy Clayton Cook. He's a psychology professor at the University of Minnesota. And I asked him, what is going on? Like, why do so few people do the things they know are good for them on a consistent basis? And here's the first thing he had to say.
Most people are confronted with scenarios in which they have to exhibit a high amount of self-control to resist particular temptations to, let's say, eat a particular food. You're at an event, it's right in front of you, or it's in your cupboard. Now, that requires self-control. To manage an impulse or an urge to want to do something, basically, it requires kind of saying no to something that you should indeed say no to. And then alternatively, it requires saying yes to things that we should say yes to, like getting up and getting physical activity. But sometimes we might have fatigue, or we might have the thought that we don't want to do it. And that's just kind of an impulse or urge. And it's kind of being able to overcome that initial impulse and urge. And so we know that a lot of people have never, you know, kind of exercised their self-control and built it to a sufficient level to be able to engage and execute these kind of healthy habits.
Okay, so that's in the short term,
yeah.
Right? Don't eat that Oreo when it's in front of you.
Exactly. And then he says in the long term, it's all about habit formation. Like, you've got to figure out some skills so that you can get rid of the bad habits if you're a smoker, for example, or you eat badly, and start getting some good habits around doing those things. And those are skills you can actually learn. And of course, psychologists say that they can help you with those skills. That's what they do. That's why they hang out a shingle. And here's what he had to say about learning those skills.
If you imagine for some younger person, I want to be able to be a grandparent one day and I want to be healthy and mobile enough. That's a long-term goal. Now, can I, in the moment, in my everyday circumstances, manage my thoughts, the feelings that come up, or the impulses to engage in maladaptive, unhelpful behaviors in pursuit of that goal? And that's where self-regulation is really viewed as from a skill perspective, that people can acquire those skills to better manage like unhelpful thoughts or feelings that might cause them to want to go smoke or drink too much because they're using it to cope with stress or something like that.
So that's Clayton Cook, psychology professor at the University of Minnesota. Anyone who has bad habits can maybe talk to him because he sounds really good at this stuff.
Is there really an underlying cause to all of that, or is it just, like, seriously, if I had a choice between a piece of broccoli and a donut, I mean...
You are going to eat the broccoli every time,
there's
Madeline.
No childhood trauma that's going to point me to the donut. It's just QED. There it is.
Well, I asked our listeners, I reached out for a little feedback to see what listeners think about all of this stuff, and Caroline O said, considering climate change, I'm not sure if I want to live any longer. Ooh,
oh,
Caroline, come
okay.
on. And then Angie Baraha says, where is the list that's for living longer and enjoying life? Yes, kind of what I was saying earlier. Raoul Duke says, try to incorporate sex, drugs, and rock and roll into your daily routine. That'll do it for you. So ran a poll to see which of the five things are actually most difficult for people to stick with. Which can't they stick with? And the winner was exercising every day, kind of what I thought it might be.
Like, yeah.
Being able to do that is tough for people. Second place was eating a healthy diet. That one is tough too. I thought drinking in moderation would come up higher, but that was third. And keeping a healthy weight, they're both about the same as well. So those two things people have a tough time with. Some people say they're all easy. I don't.
You do.
I don't.
Okay. Thank you, Christian Bordahl, our resident Norwegian. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.